We're going to begin with Amy Catherine Glassmeyer. Now, she is a professor of economic geography and regional planning at MIT, which means she's already got me intimidated like you couldn't possibly believe. She is also a founding editor of the Cambridge Journal of Regions, Economy and Society. So I wanted to talk to her or get an opportunity to visit with her about where we're at with living wages, how we compare here in the upper Midwest. Ms. Glassmeyer, good to have you on News and Views. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation to talk with you today.
A lot of people believe that because everywhere we drive right now, and I don't know if it's where you're at, but if you go anywhere, there's a help wanted sign right now. There's help wanted here, there. And it isn't just fast food places or, I mean, there's help wanted everywhere. And so we've been having a lot of conversation about, you know, wages and where wages are and where they should go and where they need to be. How do we compare here in the Midwest in regards to those issues versus others when it comes to minimum wage?
Well, the Midwest is a big area. And so the thinking about the living wage, you have to really think local rather than regional, although there is actually a regional signal. So, for example, if you asked me what was the highest wage region in the United States, I would say to you that it, the order is Northeast, West, Midwest, and South. And that might surprise you because the history of the Midwest is that it was a high wage region as a result of the manufacturing base. But over the last 40 years, as manufacturing has declined, the Midwestern wage rates have declined as well. But there was always a bit of a misconception about wage rates in the Midwest, because actually the Midwest wasn't at the highest cost location, but certain industries were very high cost. So where you stand today depends on what your economic base is. If your economic base is tourism, then it's probably going to be a lower wage than what you might find if you had a, if you were in a city in which you had a diversified economic base. If you were a college town, chances are you would have a living wage that was closer to what we might think is a wage people can live on, but it would probably still not be sufficient to cover people's basic costs.
Here's where I struggle, Professor. I struggle living where I live here in the upper Midwest when I get into discussions with people and we start debating, you know, what a living wage gives you versus what your expenses are. And I don't think people realize, you know, we can sit there and have a conversation. Well, there's a job. Man, can you believe they're paying $15 an hour? And it's like $15 an hour is $30,000 a year. And then you start breaking down a car payment, an apartment payment, you know, daycare, those type of things. And it doesn't take long until you don't have any money. And at times, I just wonder if people in the upper Midwest get that. Because there's a perception here, Professor, that it's far cheaper to live here than it is anywhere else. And I'm not convinced that that's true. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
I would say that it depends on if you're in an urban or a rural area. That's one thing that's important to point out. And the second thing is it depends on what kind of a household you are, whether you're an individual, whether you're two adults, one working, two adults both working, whether there are children involved. But in general, people have a misconception about the cost of living in places where it tends to be a bit more rural, and it also tends to be, you know, made up of smaller towns. And the reason why people have misconceptions is because they're not thinking in terms of supply. So, for example, in a small town, you might not be able to find very much in the way of rental housing if you don't have money to buy a house. And if there's not much supply, then the price of the rental can be the discretion of the person who owns the property. So there are lots of ways in which some of the areas within the Midwest people might think, oh, it's really inexpensive to live there. But in fact, when you add everything up, like how much farther you have to drive, what your limits, your option, limited options are for health care, your limited options for child care, you put them all together, and you're not necessarily advantaged.
Oh, when you take a look at what's happening here, let's use North Dakota as the example.
So tell me where here is. That's where you're located.
North Dakota. Let's use North Dakota as the example.
I know, but what county do you live in?
Okay, I live in Richland. We're talking about Cass. But the question I'm going to ask isn't just based off of that. It's based off of a statewide issue, because North Dakota grew at the highest percentage of any state in the union during the last census. But when you look at it, 30 counties out of the 53, and they are rural, Professor, they are rural counties, 30 of those lost population. And so we're going through a redistricting process in the legislature, which shows, exactly where people have moved to, and they're all urban areas. What we define as urban areas, Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks, Williston, Minot, towns like that, you know, which to us are bigger cities. And so I think you could make an argument that that's where the money is. That's where the pay is. And you could say, well, that's where the careers are too, in terms of what people are challenged with. But, you know, to me, if you want people to stay in small towns, you got to pay them better. And I'm curious if your study, if what you've looked at has shown any of that.
Well, let's begin by saying that the existing federal minimum wage is not a living wage for anyone, anywhere in the country. It doesn't matter how rural you are. It is not a sufficient amount of money for somebody to live on. It requires usually about 2.5 minimum wages to be able to make it possible for a person to get by. So when we're up in the $14 to $16 an hour range, then we are getting to a point where the basics can be covered. And then it all depends on if you're an individual or if you're a family and if you have children and how many people are working. And the more you add children and the more you add childcare, as an example, the further and further away people are from being able to cover their basic costs. And that's because childcare is both a scarce resource. It's also an area that requires a reasonable wage. Because parents want their children to be cared for appropriately, and so it's very expensive. You know, I'm looking at Cass County right now, and the child care costs in Cass County don't look a whole lot different to me than when I'm looking at parts of Massachusetts. So if you have three kids, it's $23,000 a year just for childcare.
They're not. But Professor, they're not. And that's an argument that I have every day here on talk radio, is people say, well, it's way cheaper to live here. And if you look at some of the basic expenses and you look at what happens in Cass County, we're in the 98 to 99 percentile. And so, you know, how would you make an argument to people that when the first thing they say to you in regards to the minimum wage is that, well, that's just part-time beginning, you know, high school kid type of stuff. And then you say, no, there are people in this society that is what they're expected to earn. And so, you know, am I right in saying that there are a lot of people that aren't teenagers that are making minimum wage?
Well, there's a whole set of jobs that are being started at minimum wage. A statistic that you might find surprising is 60% of all jobs in the United States are listed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as requiring only a high school education. There are people who counter that by saying that we're not measuring the value of labor and human capacity fairly. We are underpaying people really based on a legacy effect associated with that mindset you described, rather than actually being able to assess an individual's capability. Let me give you an example. somebody who is working in a fast food joint. So they get started out at a minimum wage, and they're thought of as not being, you know, there is sort of like, that's a very basic job. Well, the truth is, it's not a basic job. You've got hygiene you have to worry about. You have security you have to worry about. You have to have language that you have to worry about. You have to make sure the food is cooked properly. You have to address people in a polite manner. You have to be able to make change. You have to be able to hear. You have to deal with multiple languages. So that's not a basic job. That's a complex job. We just have had a lagging minimum wage for 35 years. And until we fix that, people are going to be underpaid.
Okay, what about the argument that people make, which is if we raise the minimum wage, we're going to lose jobs and we're going to lose those individuals who make just above minimum wage?
So here's a thought experiment. Imagine that all over the country, the minimum wage was raised to $14.66 an hour. What would happen if it happened all over the country? What do you think would happen?
Well, what I think would happen is we'd have an economy that would flourish rather than suffer because of it. There's others who believe it'd be inflation.
What would happen is, first off, there would not be wage competition. Everybody would basically be starting at a floor, right? That would be the floor. In the short run, the standard of living for everybody would rise because they would have twice as much money as they had if they were making the minimum wage. Then there would be starting, you know, moving around, and there might be competition for people who are more highly skilled and they get more money. But actually, raising the minimum wage, if it was done on a national basis, yes, companies would have to figure out how to make their workers, how to first off accept that their workers are more valuable than they think they are, and then second, how to improve their productivity so that the returns on their labor is equivalent to the wages that are being paid. But if you made it across the board, everybody would be in the same position. My brother's a machine designer, and he said to me, and he's very conservative, and he said, you know, the best thing that could ever happen is if the whole country had a $15 an hour wage rate, because then I, living in California, wouldn't be constantly struggling with competition of people in other parts of the country with the same skill level being paid less money. That's what my brother said, which
exactly.
is totally shocking to me.
But he's right. But he's absolutely
right.
He is right. Yep. So if people want to find out more about your work, they want to see some of and read some of what we're talking about here, where do they go, Professor? How can they find that?
Well, the first thing they can do is just Google living wage, and that will take them to the living wage calculator. And on the calculator are, you know, maybe 5 years of stories of different experiences of people in living wages. And then if they Google living wage, what they'll do is they'll come across a vast number of stories that are being written by people all over the country. And they're reporting that companies are starting to pay living wages. And it's not everyone, but there are lots of organizations that I deal with and I work with to facilitate their understanding of what it means to pay a living wage and how it affects the well-being and the mental outlook of their employees. So it's everywhere. I mean, I get probably 25 Google alerts a day and in two different feeds that basically talk nothing but about living wages.
Oh. Professor, I thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
Professor Glassmeyer, ladies and gentlemen, when we come back, your thoughts on what she just said.